Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. This week it's Oldsmobile Part 2. Last week we talked about steam engines and all the old-timey stuff. This week we're going to be talking about the stuff you guys know, the 442, Rocket 88, the Alero, the Achieva, the Bravada. We're going to get into all that. How did this brand go from one of the most successful car companies in American history to a quiet, whimpering death? Well, we're going to talk about it right now. Let's get into it. Last time on Pass Gas, we traced the rise of Oldsmobile from a steam-powered family business to one of the best-selling badges in American car history. Through thick and thin, the company survived and thrived, but they are about to face some of their biggest challenges yet, including another world war. Today on Pass Gas, why did one of the most important car companies in American history vanish? What went wrong inside General Motors? And how did Oldsmobile go from cutting edge to the graveyard? This week on Pass Gas is Oldsmobile Part 2. Welcome to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes.
You already clapped.
Joined, as always, by Bart Bidlingmeyer across from me. Hello,
hey,
Bart.
Guys.
Welcome. Welcome again.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun episode.
I think so.
Happy to be here.
And Joe Weber.
Let me hear you at home. Give me a clap. There you are.
There you go.
Right, that was so corny.
This is Oldsmobile Part 2. Last week, we talked about their early beginnings from Ranny Olds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The engineer extraordinaire.
Yeah, went from steam engines to gas engines.
That's right.
And then that darn Smith family took
and
over.
And then also Ranny proved, screw you guys, I'm going home.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like he was right again.
Yeah.
You know?
Started REO. He sold more for a little while than Oldsmobile. Oldsmobile really kind of bounces back. We see the creation of GM coming in.
Which saved them.
Was more of just like a
name buy.
Yeah. I mean, their whole strategy was buying established brands and building up a portfolio. Building up the brand ladder, a bunch of different brands at different price points. And I think we're about to get into World War II now. So,
yay!
Shall we?
Always fun.
Let's do it.
Always. What's a past gas without a little foyer and a foray into World War II?
It'd be they're rare.
I feel like the last five have just hammered through.
Well, World Porsche War II. Nürburgring.
Yeah, Porsche Nürburgring.
Lamborghini. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess Lamborghini was after.
No, but I mean he was involved.
In he took tank parts to make his tractors. That's true.
You know, it was kind of like
Caterpillar.
Big deal. Mm-hmm. That event.
A lot got tied up into World War II.
Well, if we ever do a Swiss company, then
what a relief. To talk about it.
As America bounced back from the Great Depression, so too did Oldsmobile. In 1940, Oldsmobile introduced the Hydromatic Transmission, which was the first fully automatic gearbox ever offered in a mass-produced car. It cost just $57 to add to any model in the company's lineup. The move helped cement Oldsmobile's reputation as GM's go-to brand for experimentation and cutting-edge technology.
It's fun that this is cutting-edge technology and we're portraying it as such. And it's the first automatic transmission in a mass-produced car. But another way to look at it is this is the beginning of the end of the manual transmission for $57.
Yeah. The 40s were poised to be Oldsmobile's most successful decade yet, until the U.S. entered World War II. Production of all civilian cars was halted by a government order on January 1, 1942, the very same day that Olds Motor Works was officially renamed the Oldsmobile Division of General Motors. From that point through the end of World War II, Oldsmobile factories switched to defense manufacturing. Floor workers were dubbed soldiers of production, producing millions of rounds of ammunition, as well as tens of thousands of aircraft, machine guns, and tank cannons.
So we're basically like soldiers of content.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We're not at war, though, thankfully.
Yeah.
When the war ended, Oldsmobile went right back to making cars and didn't miss a beat. In fact, just a few short years later, the company launched perhaps its most enduring contribution to the American auto industry, a new overhead valve V8 engine called the Rocket. Oldsmobile had begun developing a flathead V8 shortly after the war, but the project ran into resistance from Cadillac executives who had their own V8 and didn't want another GM division to build something similar.
I love that it's GM, baby. Getting into it.
It's just amazing that they hadn't figured out, like, oh, we should just develop one power plant mm-hmm. and use it across our product line right. rather than right. every company, you need to make your own engine. Right. You know?
Yeah. It's crazy. There's so much infighting in GM. Mm-hmm. Story we talk about. Yeah.
yeah. Like it works sometimes and then not others. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the infighting. All right, guys, we did it. And then overhead comes in like, nah, sorry, you can't. Oldsmobile already did.
Yeah.
You know, like, we want to do it.
Oldsmobile engineers sidestep these objections from Cadillac by using a 90-degree V angle and an overhead valve design to differentiate the two projects.
Because the other one was 60-degree?
Well, the last Olds one was 60-degree, yeah. right?
Probably well, they had their 60. Own V8, yeah. By moving the valves above the cylinders, Oldsmobile's new engine allowed for better airflow, improved combustion, and more power per cubic inch. This engine would turn out to be the first mass-produced overhead valve V8, setting the template for the engines that would help define the U.S. auto industry for decades to come. Dude, so many innovations at Oldsmobile. Yeah. This is crazy.
It's unreal. Yeah.
I had no idea. Olds named it the Rocket in a nod to the public's post-war fascination with space and missile technology. The Rocket engine debuted in Oldsmobile's top-of-the-line 98 series, paired with the new Futuromic styling, which looks, that's pretty neat.
Yeah. Oh, that I forgot about that Olds hood ornament in the front.
What's the hood ornament?
Oh, it's kind of like a plane or a rocket. And then when you get the smaller one, it's still that, but everything's designed from this point on in their logos to be, to evoke a plane or a rocket.
Oh, gotcha. It almost looks like the old Pontiac hood ornament. That was like the chieftain. Mm-hmm. The long chieftain
that
was like quartz looking or something, like see-through.
Mm-hmm. 2 months later, in February of 1949, Oldsmobile introduced another landmark vehicle, the 88. Designed by engineer Harold Metzel, the 88 body was smaller and about 300 pounds lighter than the 98, but still had that Rocket V8 in it.
I wonder if that's the wheelbase.
Because
88 would be a shorter one than obviously 98. But
that's interesting. They're probably right.
You want to look it up real quick?
The 1949 Oldsmobile 88's wheelbase, 119 inches. Oh.
That's long. That makes sense. That's long.
Big boy. The Rocket 88 used the simple formula of small car plus big V8, which is why it's considered by some to be the first muscle car more than a decade before the Pontiac GTO. It could hit 60 miles per hour in just under 13 seconds.
Wow, that's a ripper.
I mean, it was impressive performance for the era and quickly earned a reputation as being a true driver's car. Hell yeah, dude. Big ass car, slow as f***. that's enthusiast right there, dude. That same year,
a formula that Oldsmobile kept until they went under.
That same year, a racing series got its start called the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, or NASCAR, and Oldsmobile jumped at the chance to enter the Rocket 88. It ended up winning the first three NASCAR Cups from 1949 to 1951, driven by the legendary Red Byron. It also inspired the 1951 single Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston, considered by some historians to be the first rock and roll song. Okay.
It's great. Like, Oldsmobile is also pretty heavily tied to American musical history.
Yeah, it's weird.
Is pop music, in fact.
Well, there's that Kendrick song about Oldsmobile. In my Alero. Bought an Alero for the weekend.
Production numbers tell the rest of the story. In 1949, Oldsmobile built nearly 294,000 vehicles.
Wow.
More than 100,000 of them were 88s, despite its mid-year launch. That's a big success. By 1950, output rose to over 416,000 units, a new all-time high for the company. The Rocket 88 enhanced Oldsmobile's reputation as an innovator and would remain in production for over 40 years. Good Lord. 40.
Imagine, like, 40. Redoing Fast and Furious in this time, and the cops are like chasing them down at like 42 miles per hour. Like, I can't catch up.
Oldsmobile founder Ransom Olds may have passed away in 1950, but his old company kept chugging along. Oldsmobile entered the 50s with momentum, powered by a winning formula of strong performance and appealing styling. The 88 was dominating NASCAR, winning 10 of 19 races in 1950 and 20 of 41 races in 1951. Sales remained strong despite production restrictions caused by the Korean War. And during the conflict, Oldsmobile contributed to the war effort by producing nearly 8.5 million bazooka rockets, making this our very first mention of the bazooka on the podcast. In 1955, Oldsmobile produced nearly 600,000 vehicles, overtaking Plymouth to become the fourth largest car manufacturer in the U.S. But another downturn was coming, and it would be 10 more years before Oldsmobile could reach that level again. Several factors contributed to Oldsmobile's next decline. The brand lost its competitive edge on the racetrack. American buyers began shifting away from large sedans in favor of smaller imports like the Volkswagen Beetle. And a sharp recession in 1957 further strained the market. Perhaps just as important, though, by the late 1950s, Oldsmobile's lineup had become difficult to distinguish from its GM siblings, Pontiac and Buick. As the economic recession compressed GM's pricing structure, style became one of Oldsmobile's few differentiators, but that also backfired with an unpopular, overly chromed 1950 lineup. Caught between Pontiac and Buick in GM's brand hierarchy, Oldsmobile lacked a clear identity. To stay relevant, the division turned to technical innovation once again. In 1962, Oldsmobile introduced the turbocharged F-85 Jetfire. Mm. Along with the Corvair Monza Spitfire, the Jetfire was one of America's first high-volume turbocharged cars.
Hell yeah.
It produced 215 horsepower and could reach 0 to 60 in 8.5 seconds.
That's like...
Like that. Oh. Not bad.
I think there's one in Leno's garage.
Probably.
Oh. Yeah, that would make sense.
He also has a Tornado that's really sick.
Call her like root beer.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Reliability issues led Oldsmobile to abandon the Jetfire Turbo after just 2 years, but the company quickly rebounded with a much bigger success, the 1966 Tornado. Designed to compete with the Ford Thunderbird, the Tornado was a personal luxury coupe that pushed the boundaries of what an American car could be by just being that.
That's I think it looks sick. There was one parked, and it was like a turquoise, anyways, but... Just when you see him, yeah, just street parked. This is when I lived in Hollywood. It looks like it's fast. You know, it looks like it's fast. Yeah. When it's parked, it looks like it's moving.
Yeah.
It was front wheel drive.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
The name was deliberately futuristic sounding, designed to evoke speed and technology without referencing any actual existing object. Its bold styling set it apart visually, but the real innovation was in the engineering. As Bart mentioned, the Tornado was the first mass-produced front-wheel drive American car in more than 30 years, making it a radical departure in a market dominated by rear-wheel drive layouts. This allowed for a flatter floor, better traction in poor weather, and a roomier cabin. Powered by a massive 425 cubic inch V8 making 385 horsepower, the Tornado could hit nearly 135 miles per hour, blending muscle car performance with grand touring comfort.
That's crazy. What year was it?
This was late 60s? 66.
Do a bunch of front wheel peels in that thing?
Yeah. I was thinking it'd be fun to set up a handbrake for the front wheels. Skid your front wheels everywhere. Or like do backwards drifting.
Sure.
Kind of sick. The car was a hit with critics and enthusiasts alike. The Tornado won Motor Trend's Car of the Year Award in 1966 and helped solidify Oldsmobile's reputation as GM's most technically adventurous division. It proved that Olds can make bold, forward-thinking cars, at least for the time being.
That is a crazy front-wheel drive V8 with that much horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a boat of a car, too, and without, like, a transmission
but
tunnel
it's also,
in it.
And it's, yeah, no transmission tunnel, and it's lower, too, just generally.
Yeah, they're low.
It's,
yeah. Pretty yeah. sick, dude. Yeah.
I like the headlights on them. Mm-hmm. But it's funny that the marketing department was like, and if you reference anything that's a real object.
The 70s were a difficult decade for most of the American car industry, but Oldsmobile just kept growing. Through the oil crises, new strict regulations, and rising competition from Japan, annual production climbed from 560,000 units in 71 to over a million in 1977, 78, and 79. From 72 to 79, Oldsmobile ranked third in U.S. auto sales and production every year. Wow, I honestly did not know they were
so
successful.
Crazy? I feel like this, like in my mind, the 70s are the Oldsmobile. Like every Oldsmobile I think of is from the 70s.
The 442. That's, yeah. And the 442. The front grille is where it's split. It's just such a look. And the ones like in the 442 where the hood was actually part flipped down in the front.
Yeah.
So sick. Part of that success was due to the popular Cutlass model.
Yep.
First introduced in 1961 as a trim level on the compact F-85, the Cutlass eventually became its own model. By the mid-1960s, it had grown into a mid-sized car and become one of the best-selling lines in the country, especially in its sportier versions like the Cutlass Supreme and 442. The 442 in particular became Oldsmobile's signature muscle car. First introduced in 1964 as an option package for the F-85 and Cutlass, its name was simple. It had a four-barrel carburetor, four-speed manual transmission, and dual exhaust.
So that's so funny.
I know.
Like, it's also because they went from "Don't you dare reference a thing on the car."
Yeah, no, it's like to three the most random. Basic,
yeah. Four barrel carb.
The 442 became
a Rochester carburetor. I think that's what Oldsmobile was using.
Oh, really?
Those big, yeah.
Rochester. What about Dorchester?
The Dorchester carburetor. It's gonna beat the crap out of you.
Probably call you a slur.
Probably. Guaranteed.
Guaranteed to call you a slur.
The 442 became a standalone model in 1968. And by 1970, a top-tier W30 version came with a 455 cubic inch V8 that made up to 370 horsepower and 500 pounds-feet of torque.
What is that, like almost 8 liter?
What was the displacement?
Yeah, it was almost 8. Jeez. It's enormous. Those numbers put it right in the mix with the era's top muscle cars like the GTO, the Dodge Charger, and Chevelle SS. But the 442 stood out because it blended raw power with Oldsmobile's more upscale image.
Yeah. It also, the look, I think, again, the fastback that, I think it was Irv Verbicki, anyways, that Chevy made.
Yeah, Irv Verbicki.
Yeah, that kind of changed this look. So now all of these other companies have that platform to make these super slippery looking
these things are Chevelle-esque. Sick,
yeah. His first one was the Supernova, which never made it to production, but we talked about it in the Camaro episode.
Yeah. This is a sick era of muscle car where they're two-door.
442, mm-hmm. I think, is one of those cars where, like, look, there's the boomer market people, you know, those people are still, like, driving up the value of these cars. They're buying cars they wanted when they were younger. I think cars like Charger, Challenger, Nova, Chevelle, Camaro will all always hold their value, always be like desirable, expensive cars.
Yeah, yeah.
But something like this 442 might fly under the radar.
Sure. Right. Because it's an Oldsmobile and it's dead now.
Yeah.
Right? There's not like Oldsmobile guys now.
Like, I think now probably finding a good condition 442 is still, that's expensive. It's, but we think like 10, 15 years from now when like boomers are...
Dead.
Not all of them, but a lot of them. Like, they're not, you know, that'll be a smaller portion of this market, I think.
Who hasn't, the smaller portion that has a nostalgia for this car.
Exactly.
Versus the market that says, oh, that's a good car and I want it.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, it's not
a nostalgia based.
It's not nostalgia. Yeah. This is not like a pop culture icon in the same way. It's like a Challenger or something. Like, keep this on your short list.
And it did. It was not like a character car in a movie.
Right.
No.
Like, there's none of the bullet stuff. Yeah. There's,
you know what I drove
point.
That I really want now is one of the, a Judge GTO.
Oh, yeah?
Got to drive one of those, and I was like, oh, this is...
It's really fun.
This is me, right? But even though those are expensive, too, because, like, it's the GTO.
But that Cutlass body is a little... It's actually, like, handles pretty well. Oh. So
nice.
Hell yeah.
Let's all get 442s.
Let's do it.
And we're spend like so much money on gas every
week. It's true.
Oldsmobile's innovations continued through the 70s when they became the first American brand to offer airbags. The company was also a leading adopter of diesel.
It was just let's be honest though, it was just a paper bag you blew up and put on your dash just in case.
The concept was like a popcorn bag and they had a little microwave and it would.
The
company was also the leading adopter of diesel engines in response to rising fuel prices. Olds engineers at the time joked that, quote, we can just about dieselize anything.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they had a diesel option for like the 88 and the 98.
Isn't that like one of the worst diesels like ever made?
Yes. Yeah. Just because it's not, it works.
It was a gasoline, it was a gasser that they had like
converted. I think they took the 408 to make it run on diesel.
Well, yeah.
I think we're going to talk about it in one second.
Okay, cool.
Okay, we'll get there.
Let's do it.
We'll get there.
Don't spill the beans yet.
It's funny how excited we're getting about Oldsmobile.
Yeah.
And Noah was like really excited to get into this episode, I think. We're like, this is going to be good. We're going to, but as things are coming up, we're like, oh, yeah, remember, you know, it's been fun.
I think it's because a lot of their cars fly under the radar.
Yeah.
You don't think of them as like a performance company.
The 1973 oil embargo fundamentally changed the auto industry in the U.S.
I've never heard of that. Can you go into that?
And Oldsmobile initially seemed well-positioned to benefit. The division quickly retooled its lineup around smaller, more efficient engines while maintaining the comfort and features that middle-class buyers expected. The Cutlass, in particular, continued to sell well during this period. By offering a smaller, more efficient package with Oldsmobile's traditional refinement, the Cutlass captured buyers fleeing both gas-guzzling domestic cars and unfamiliar imports. From 1975 to 77, the Cutlass was America's best-selling car. But Oldsmobile's success during the energy crisis came at a hidden cost that would soon become apparent. In 1977, facing a shortage of its Rocket V8 engines, Olds began installing Chevrolet-built V8s in many of its cars without informing buyers. Oldsmobile customers saw this as a bait and switch. It's a cash grab.
It's a cash grab.
The backlash was swift, with detractors coining the scathing nickname Chevymobile.
Ha ha ha.
Got him.
God is that, dude.
Roasted.
Yeah, burnt.
You're done. You're done. GM's response certainly didn't help. Rather than reversing course, the company introduced a disclaimer, quote, GM cars are equipped with engines produced by various GM divisions.
Oh my God.
This may have resolved legal concerns, but GM's divisions had been drifting closer together in both styling and engineering for years. The disclaimer only deepened the perception that they had become interchangeable.
It's not like a LaBooBoo.
They've spent 70 years, 60 years creating very distinct classes of cars within their portfolio, and then all of a sudden they're like,
listen, let's be honest.
Yeah. It's all the same.
It's all the same stuff.
Look, you ever been to Taco Bell? It's all the same ingredients, rearranged differently.
Don't admit it. Yeah. It's you know.
We're going to knock down all these walls and make this company open concept.
You can have your TV in your kitchen.
Your kitchen. Your whole house could smell like your kitchen if you wanted to.
We'll put a bathroom right next to it.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
The second oil crisis in 1979, triggered by the Iranian Revolution, pushed Oldsmobile into an even more disastrous mistake. Facing renewed pressure for fuel efficiency and convinced that diesel technology offered a competitive advantage, Olds engineers decided to convert their existing 350 cubic inch V8 into a diesel engine. The conversion was rushed and fundamentally flawed. Diesel engines operate at compression ratios nearly three times higher than gas engines. Rather than redesigning or strengthening the engine block, Oldsmobile engineers simply modified the fuel system and increased the compression ratio.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
They failed to add the additional head bolts necessary to contain the increased pressure. The results were catastrophic. The converted diesel engines began failing within months, often suffering blown head gaskets. Customers reported engine seizing, excess smoke, and oil contamination.
It's also a huge reason why that diesel thing never happened. Like, it was an uphill battle to get Americans to want to use diesel in the first place. And then that happened. So suddenly everybody's like, well, never doing that.
Yep. Yeah. These twin disasters marked a turning point for Oldsmobile. A car that had built its reputation in part on engineering excellence now faced widespread customer distrust. Both problems would haunt the brand for years to come, contributing to the gradual erosion of customer loyalty that ultimately led to Oldsmobile's demise.
Well, and they'd been using the 350 for like 40 years.
It's a Rocket 88.
So
updated.
And they was detune it. You'd still have the four-barrel carburetor making 180 horsepower on a 5.7 liter engine.
Jeez.
Put some big jets in that thing. Let's fatten it up. In 1984, GM chairman Roger Smith launched a major reorganization that permanently changed how divisions like Oldsmobile operated. Instead of designing and engineering their own cars, Oldsmobile was placed into the Buick Oldsmobile Cadillac Group, which centralized product development. Smith had become GM's chairman in 1981 with a mandate to modernize the world's largest automaker, but his decisions would prove devastating for Oldsmobile. A finance executive who had risen through GM's accounting ranks, Smith believed the company's future lay in high-tech manufacturing and global expansion rather than traditional brand management. Smith's reorganization strategy centered on reducing costs through platform sharing and eliminating redundancies between divisions. He consolidated engineering operations, stripped individual brands of their autonomy, and pushed for common components across all GM vehicles.
There had always been GM part sharing, which is one of the reasons people liked GM to work on, because you knew you could get your parts. But it was also mostly just drivetrain were similar and chassis. Other than that, they were it's like, do whatever you want for a while.
And this was at a time when like Chrysler had just done this with Lee Iacocca ahead.
Lee Iacocca.
From then on, Olds no longer controlled its own engineering, only their sales and marketing. This shift robbed Oldsmobile of what had once set it apart, the freedom to design and build its own vehicles. Yeah. Now, the company's engineers were essentially just one voice in a much larger GM chorus and were often ignored by corporate product teams. Ironically, this strategy worked for Oldsmobile, and this period marked the brand's commercial peak.
It's really funny that every time they're like, you know, this could be a hurdle, it makes their brand boring, but then they thrive.
Yeah.
Oldsmobile sold more cars in 1984 than any other year, with annual sales topping 1 million units from 1983 through 1986.
But it's also, I think, at this point, because the people who know Oldsmobile as a brand, like, they know the name, and they're ready to buy cars that don't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they're at that age where it's like, I just need a car. I'll get an Oldsmobile. They're good cars.
Yeah.
You know, I think that exists for them, and that's now they're selling a lot of them.
Even at this high point, the core of the brand was beginning to erode. Oldsmobiles ever increasingly resembled models from Buick, Pontiac, and Chevrolet. Meanwhile, the company's dealers were pushing for copies of whichever vehicle types were currently popular, including minivans, SUVs, and compacts, which further diluted Oldsmobile's identity.
If you're GM, I'm thinking, why let every brand make the minivan? Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't let Cadillac.
No. Yeah.
You know, so like, pick, it'd be like, good, you guys make, this way we can keep some brand identity. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
In the 80s, consumer tastes were also shifting. Mid-market buyers gravitated towards imports, which were perceived as better built and more reliable. Seeking to reverse its fortunes, Oldsmobile launched a rebranding campaign centered around a cringy new slogan, "This is not your father's Oldsmobile." Oh
my God. It's funny because wasn't Buick was like, "It's not your grandma's Buick."
They just reused the same. Oh my God.
In an effort to appeal to younger drivers, Oldsmobile also ran a series of TV ads featuring aging celebrities like Leonard Nimoy and Ringo Starr, and paired with their non-famous children.
You, you want to get kids on board, use aging actors. Yeah.
Spock drives it and his son. Spock's son drives an Oldsmobile. Yeah.
In the cases of Mel Blanc and Rod Serling, the celebrities were quite literally dead. The marketing fell flat and sales dropped by 100,000 units the year after the ads debuted. In 1986, Oldsmobile sold over 1 million cars, all of them developed when the division still had control over its own design. By 1991, that number had dropped by more than 60%, with a lineup that was now including rebadged GMC SUVs like the Bravada Chevy minivans. Meanwhile, Roger Smith was pouring money into a new domestic brand called Saturn. Launched in 1990 with a $5 billion investment, Smith saw Saturn as GM's import fighter and gave it the same innovative mission that had once belonged to Oldsmobile. While Saturn developed new materials, manufacturing processes, and dealer relationships, Oldsmobile was left with increasingly similar products and a diminished identity. With this, Oldsmobile lost not just its competitive momentum, but its reason for existing.
I wonder if Saturn is a good story to tell.
I think it is. I mean,
yeah. We were talking about buying Saturn for a while. I think that'd be really
funny.
Yeah.
Okay. We're telling the story of Oldsmobile over the course of 100 years and GM and the pitfalls. Saturn's like, you can do that, but it took
it took 14 years.
Yeah. A speed run.
But it's like it's a microcosm of the whole thing.
By 1992, Oldsmobile's position inside GM had started to slip. The Washington Post reported that GM execs had been giving serious consideration that year to killing the brand, only to pull back at the last minute. GM and Oldsmobile denied the story vigorously, but a seed of doubt was planted in the mind of buyers. Around the same time, GM began another reorganization that would have lasting effects across the company. As part of the restructuring, GM dissolved its group system, including Buick, Oldsmobile, Cadillac. Now, engineering and manufacturing for all GM brands were centralized under a single corporate office. Oldsmobile's core problem at this point was one of identity. It had once thrived by offering innovation and distinctiveness, but without those traits, it struggled to hold on to a reason for being. Oldsmobile cycled through 6 brand managers over 13 years, each tasked with finding a new direction and none ever finding success. GM's increasing reliance on platform sharing only blurred the lines further. By the late 80s and into the 90s, Oldsmobile's cars had become nearly indistinguishable from their Buick, Pontiac, and Chevy siblings. In a market that was rapidly diversifying and shifting towards imports, the overlap made Oldsmobile feel redundant. Models like the Achieva, launched in the early 90s, were functional but bland and did little to revive the brand's appeal.
Did Oldsmobile make any concept cars in that period? Because I know Cadillac was, Buick was.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, they did some concept cars.
Remember Eddie had his Alero?
Yeah.
The old Alero, yeah. Man.
The Alero was a Pontiac Grand Am rebadged.
That makes sense.
Which is like, that was a good car for the time.
I love those Pontiacs.
Yeah. But no, it's also funny that if... Like you're saying, it was a rebadged Grand Am. Like, great.
Yeah.
But if you're Oldsmobile, you don't want to talk about that. No. But it's the only way you're going to get somebody to buy it.
Yeah. So.
Compounding problems, Oldsmobile remained primarily an American car brand throughout its history. Unlike Chevrolet, Buick, or Cadillac, the brand was designed specifically for the American middle class and American driving conditions, with an emphasis on comfort, size, and highway performance that reflected distinctly American preferences. European and Asian consumers preferred smaller, more efficient vehicles. The company chose to export Chevrolet as its volume brand and develop regional nameplates like Opel in Europe rather than expanding existing American divisions. By the time GM began serious globalization efforts in the 1980s and 1990s, Oldsmobile was already struggling domestically and suffering from an identity crisis that made international expansion impossible.
And it doesn't have the same kind of prestige in the name.
Right.
So like if you were to export it, you know, can you imagine someone in Spain being like, what the fuck is Oldsmobile?
Yeah.
I want to buy Newsmobile.
Yeah.
Currentsmobile.
The company eventually pivoted towards marketing Oldsmobile as a domestic alternative to Honda, of all things.
What?
It was a risky proposition that required turning away from the existing Olds customer base in order to keep chasing younger buyers. Oldsmobile changed its entire lineup from large, old-style sedans to smaller, sportier cars in what was called the Centennial Plan. The Aurora, introduced in 1995, represented the division's final attempt at reinvention. It featured European-inspired styling and advanced engineering. The design was so radical that Oldsmobile omitted traditional badges, using only a circular A logo. Internal discussions reportedly even considered renaming the entire division Aurora.
But the circular A logo was another take on the historic Oldsmobile logo representing a plane or a rocket ship shooting in the sky.
I like the Aurora, honestly.
The Aurora's, it's got a 4-liter V8. I didn't realize that.
There's something so comforting about these, like, 90s blob cars.
I mean,
cars.
It looks like a Ford Contour. Yeah. Like, it's just, like, familiar, you know?
Just like, oh, I'm driving home to my
you know, it kind of smells a little bit like cigarettes.
Cigarettes, yep.
Yeah.
When you look at it, though, you'd say, if you're trying to compete with Honda...
What the fuck are you doing?
You're not doing it right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still too long. It's still too... Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big car. I can just see, like, driving to my job at the factory in the Midwest somewhere.
Mm-hmm. You're three deep in the front.
Yeah.
Four in the back.
Yeah.
Smoking a cigarette. listening to AM radio.
Heading back from the bowling alley.
Yeah, dude.
All bundled up in your down.
Yeah.
You work there, but you also play there. Mm-hmm.
So the move with the Aurora backfired. While the Aurora helped lower the brand's average buyer age from 60 to 49.
Average was 60?
Holy shit.
What?
The shift came at a cost. Older customers who had long bought big, comfortable Oldsmobiles went elsewhere, and younger buyers weren't drawn in fast enough to replace them.
Because you still got the Panther platform. You still got Grand Marquis, the Lincoln Town Car, so they're still happening. Mm-hmm.
In other words, not enough youngs wanted an Olds.
Oh, hey-o.
Hey.
Bing bong. Got him.
Dealer rebellion became common during this era of Oldsmobile's decline. Many dealers openly criticized GM's product decision. Some threatened to drop the Oldsmobile franchise entirely, while others began emphasizing used car sales and service work over new vehicle sales.
The Aurora? You don't want that. I got some used cars for you.
By the time Oldsmobile became the first American automaker to celebrate its 100th year anniversary in 1997, it was already facing extinction. In 2000, after years of rumors, GM finally announced that Oldsmobile would be phased out. The 2004 model year would be its last.
That's still 4 years after they announced it? That's crazy. That wouldn't sell any cars.
No.
Just cut your losses there.
On April 29th, 2004, the last Oldsmobile and a Laro sedan rolled off the line in Lansing, Michigan. The workers signed the cars before it was sent to the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum. It was essentially a rebadged Pontiac Grand Am, a far cry from the innovations that had once defined the Oldsmobile brand and inspired history's first rock and roll song.
You know that Alero rolled off the factory floor smelling like cigarettes.
smoked in from the factory.
Yeah.
Well, that's like when you get, there's another tangent, but if you order stuff like furniture or whatever that is coming from Chinese factories and you open it up, you just get a whiff of just cigarette.
Do they smoke while they're working?
I have a feeling.
With that last car, Oldsmobile officially became history itself. After 107 years in operation, the oldest surviving American automobile brand was no more. In the end, maybe it's no surprise that Oldsmobile died. The word old was right there in the name all along. But the real lesson might be this. Nothing lasts forever, especially if it stops being good. After decades of innovation and reinvention, Oldsmobile ran out of ideas, then ran out of time. Still, for over a century, Oldsmobile built some of the coolest, fastest, and most influential cars in American history. From the first mass-produced American automobile to some rocket V8-powered muscle machines, they helped shape what cars would become. Not bad for a legacy of a brand that started with a three-wheeled steamer and a guy named Ranny.
Oh,
and there you go. That is Oldsmobile.
Dude, I love stories like this where you're like, this is going to be kind of a long day. And then it's like actually a really good story. And you're like, whoa, I didn't know that.
But it's also like it's stuff you forgot you knew because no one's been talking about them for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know,
there's not like an Oldsmobile enthusiast group.
Yes.
There anymore.
Probably is.
Yeah. You think so?
Someone driving a
gray 87 Cutlass that's immaculate. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I really liked my uncle's Cutlass Supreme.
Yeah.
I think it was a coupe.
Cutlass Supreme. That was the bacon tomato mayo.
Oldsmobile Club of Southern California. Official.
Whoa, okay.
These are some older ones. Oh, these are like old Oldsmobile. Like
the 40s like or old earlier than the 40s.
Oldsmobile Club of America has a 442 on the banner image. Okay. Nice. There's 56,000 members.
What?
Whoa.
How many active, though?
And three admins. Wow. Created 16 years ago, dude.
Those admins are working overtime.
That's sick, dude. That's awesome. Oldsmobile Enthusiast Car Club. 14,000 members. There's still people that love these cars.
I'm going to eat my hat now because I was so wrong.
You better start chomping on that hat.
Good thing it's a very light hat.
All right, that is our episode this week. Thank you so much for listening. Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to our crew, Audrey and Edgar, behind the camera, and our writer this week, Greg Nix. Next week, we've got
Reeves Callaway.
Reeves Callaway. Oh, hell yeah.
You talking about that sledgehammer?
Sledgehammer. Bum, bum. So stick around for that one. We'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.